board first. Inwardly, Alan cheered, even as he fought against the crimson light. It felt like pushing his way up a hill underwater, but he managed to put one foot in front of the other. Simon needed his help. An instant later, a young woman, perhaps Alan's age, with long brown hair and a red and gold dress, came to kneel beside Simon. She didn't say anything, and for a moment Alan wondered if she had come to help Simon or the Incarnation. Then Alan saw the ruby circlet gleaming on her head, and he hurried forward. He had never seen royalty before, but he wasn't a fool. He knew what a crowned woman in the Damascan royal colors meant, especially here, among the camp of the royal army. The woman stood and gestured to the side. Two soldiers ran up, grabbing Simon under the shoulders, beginning to carry him off. Alan waited for Simon to resist, but he remained as limp as a corpse. If Alan hadn't seen his head twitching, he would have thought Simon dead or unconscious. Maybe Simon had used too much power. Whenever Alan drew too much from Elysia, he felt ready to pass out. Maybe it was the same for Simon with Valenhal. No matter what, he wasn't about to let Simon be kidnapped by Damasca. He walked up behind the soldiers and summoned a globe of gold. He opened his mouth to demand Simon's return, but remembered that Simon was fighting against the Incarnation. Maybe he had friends in the Damascan army. Only Simon could confirm that for sure, so Alan changed what he was about to say. "Simon," he asked, "what's going on here?" He didn't know if Simon would have the strength to answer him, but if he didn't, Alan was more than willing to take a chance and forcibly rescue him. If it turned out later that Simon didn't need rescuing, well, he would have to explain that to Alan when he woke up. One of the soldiers dropped Simon's right side to draw his sword, but Alan just stood there, holding the glowing golden orb. This man ought to know traveler business when he saw it. If he couldn't keep his weapon to himself, Alan would teach him better. Simon's arm flopped weakly in the air, and he somehow managed to get the remaining soldier to turn him around.
"Alan," he said, in a voice that was all but a whisper.
"What?
Why?"
"I saw you fighting against that thing," Alan said, nodding to the Incarnation's corpse. "I came to help, though I see you didn't need me. Come with me, and I'll take you home."
Simon's head twitched, and Alan wondered if he was trying to shake his head. "Don't worry. Need Valenhal? You go. Not safe."
The store of words seemed to have exhausted Simon, because his chin drooped down to rest on his chest. Alan looked at him there, carried by a Damascan soldier. He was almost a full head shorter than Alan, and he seemed so powerless. Well, if he felt safe in Damascus, then Alan supposed he could leave him there. He would have to find out the story later, though. Alan looked around, searching for the noblewoman. He finally saw her standing behind the soldier with the drawn sword, gesturing insistently to her attendants behind a nearby tent. Summoning up his best king's face, Alan fixed her with a glare.
"This man is a friend and ally of mine. You should treat him well, for I will be back for him."
She turned back and met him with an even, blue-eyed gaze. Wearing a crown of Damasca and a silk dress, Leah looked back at him with the poise of a queen. Alan jerked back as if struck. He lost his concentration and the gold light in his hand evaporated. He felt like someone had stabbed him in the gut. Now that he was paying attention, he could see Leah's crystal bracelet at the end of her sleeve, her long hair, her skin that was slightly too dark for a normal Damascan.
"Leah, you... who are you?"
Leah stared at him and didn't say a word. He saw it now. She hadn't grown up in the village. She had been there almost 3 years. She had come into town on her own, with nothing more than the clothes on her back, yet somehow with enough self-assurance to talk her way inside. She claimed to be related to another villager, conveniently dead,
and had been adopted into the ranks of her extended family. It fit. It all fit. He couldn't think of a reason why Damascan royalty would want to infiltrate an ordinary village, but she had done it. Make her. How she must have been laughing at his attempts to save her, to protect her. She must have been laughing at them for years. Laughing at him. Something cold and hard grew in Alan's chest, and he threw up two walls of intersecting green plates, one on either side of Leia, trapping them in a corridor. The Damascan soldiers outside dumped Simon to the ground, shouting and pounding on the walls of green light. He didn't hear them. "Give me one reason why I shouldn't drag you to the Grandmaster's right now." Leia looked at him. She didn't seem scared. She gave him a one-handed shrug as if to say, "What can I say?" Rage and shame flared up, searing cold and smoldering hot. He seized her by the shoulders, wanting to shake her. "Talk to me," he demanded. Her blue eyes went cold, and she raised one hand, snapping her fingers once. A tanned, muscled forearm wrapped around Alan's neck, keeping him in a loose chokehold. "Release the heiress," a man behind him said. He sounded calm, almost pleasant. His arm showed a tattoo wrapping up the wrist, like a black chain. Alan took a deep breath and removed his hands from Leah's shoulders. He shouldn't have gotten violent with her. "Why not?" a voice whispered in his head. "She's the enemy." "Release me," Alan said. The arm around his neck didn't move. And Leah still didn't say anything. Silently, she watched. "Fine." Alan touched the golden power of Elysia, tapping into the force beyond sight, and launched a gold light behind him. The man behind him staggered back, and Alan turned to walk past him. He had been gone from the Grandmaster's too long. The man with the chain-wrapped arms looked to be in his 40s, with dark hair and tan skin that made him look like a villager. He wore a dark cloak like Simon's, but underneath, his shirt sleeves had been cut off to show his tattoos. He smiled broadly, rubbing his chest. "You got me there," he said. "Good shot. But I'm afraid I can't let you leave until Her Highness gives the signal." Alan wasn't feeling very tolerant. He summoned a globe of gold energy and blasted the man, intending to knock him over backwards. The energy shattered on a pale green breastplate, splashing harmlessly in the air several inches from his chest. "Maker," Alan thought. "Not another Valenhal." The Valenhal traveler stuck his hand out, summoning a long, curved sword that was chipped and pitted, as though it were one or two good cuts from breaking. Alan extended his hand, ready to summon his own gold sword. It wouldn't do him much good against Valenhal, but there were other things he could summon, as long as he survived the first round of combat. The traveler looked behind Alan and abruptly relaxed, letting his sword vanish. "That's all I needed," he said pleasantly. "Have a nice day. Next time you deal with a member of the royal family, though, try to have some better manners." Alan glanced back, where Leah stood, impassively staring at him. Had she commanded the Valenhal traveler to back off? "That's the least she should have done, seeing as she set him on me in the first place," Alan thought. He swept past the black-cloaked traveler, ignoring him. All the way back to the Enosh travelers, he all but shook with rage. She had humiliated him. He had considered her a friend, had even risked his life to save hers. And now... Wait. Did Simon know? He must. That would explain why he was fighting for Damascus in the first place. Had he known all along? The idea of the two of them with their secret, laughing together at his ignorance, felt like a knife twisting in his guts. But as painful as the thought was, he couldn't believe it. Simon was almost foolishly straightforward, and he wouldn't have kept a secret for any longer than he had to. More to the point, Alan couldn't imagine Leah keeping a secret from him and sharing it with Simon, of all people. Simon must have learned her identity recently, just as he had. But if that was true, why was he fighting for her? It was clear that Alan and Simon needed to have a long talk, fairly soon. First, Alan would break into the royal palace in Cana, burning the hanging tree and setting an incarnation loose on the city. On Leah's home. A dark, ugly part of himself took a measure of satisfaction from that thought. When he pushed his way back through the trees to see the Ragnaros gate still hanging there, he knew something was wrong. The silver doors inside had been thrown open, and the screams, shouts, and explosions of a battle between travelers sounded within. They had gone ahead without him, and they had found enemies within the vault. Good, Alan thought. He needed something to fight. Alan stepped through the gate and into the crimson vault. The air grew cooler, like a deep cave, and it carried the tang of metal. Roars and flickers of light came from within the vault itself, past the silver doors, which had been thrown wide. He hurried inside, his golden boots ringing on the stone with every step. On either side of him, the wall was carved with shelves. Each shelf held something new, gleaming in the light from crimson torches. Tentacles reached up out of clay jars, staves twisted in their racks. Swords whispered secrets to him as he passed. Each shelf had a label in gold beneath it, but he didn't slow to read any of them. The battle had pressed on, deeper into the vault, and he couldn't afford to delay any more than he already had. As he ran deeper, he began to step over the occasional body. A girl in the buckskin uniform of an Avernus traveler had a gaping hole in her chest. There was no hope for her. A few feet later, he almost tripped over an old man in Naraka robes. He was still breathing, though unconscious, so Alan gave him a quick dose of rose light. It might not make any difference, but it might be the difference that kept the man alive. He saw two or three more bodies, each one from Enosh, without a single enemy corpse among them. That worried him. But even worse were the glimpses he caught of the fight at the end of the vault. The hall to either side of him was wide enough, as it could easily fit five people walking side by side, but after about 100 steps it opened into a huge round room, easily hundreds of paces from wall to opposite wall. The weapons displayed on these shelves were massive. Entire statues, spears the size of pine trees, mirrors big enough to reflect a cathedral. And on the far wall, another portrait of the one-eyed king from the doorway glared down on everyone. In the vast space at the center of the Crimson Vault, the half a dozen travelers remaining from the Enosh assault team did battle. Galad hurled pale orange screaming fireballs with one hand, as, with his other hand, he directed a titan of living ice that had 3 hearts visible through its translucent rib cage. Grandmaster Naraka put her hand out in front of her and nearly collapsed from obvious pain as a glowing orange claw tore itself from midair, pulling the rest of its monstrous body straight from Naraka. The creature appeared to be made entirely from smoke and orange flames, and it hunched under its own weight, the backs of its shoulders scraping the ceiling. It looked like a man merged with a dragon, of all things, and as Alan watched, it leaned forward and roared its defiance at someone Alan couldn't see. Grandmaster Avernus was all but invisible, in a swarm of birds flying around her in a black tornado, and the mental screams they emitted gave Alan a headache even from 50 paces away. The rest of the travelers summoned glowing mists, floating blue skulls, living thorn bushes of ravenous obsidian, or even more exotic things that he couldn't name. And it all seemed centered on one man. Before Alan could join the other Enosh travelers, a spear blasted through the ice giant's head like a ballista bolt crashing through a glass-paned window. The resulting avalanche of ice buried Galad, who barely had the time to throw up his hands before he was entombed beneath his own summoned creature. Grandmaster Naraka's flaming giant took that opportunity to bring both of its clawed hands down on the lone enemy, but it seemed unable to penetrate the figure's raised shield. The shield was broad and black, with a gold rim around the edge, but it seemed to be made of wood. Alan would have thought that the creature of flame and fury would shred it like so much paper, but it hammered away, roaring impotently. A second later, the spear tore through the fire beast's chest. Only an instant afterward, it flew forward again, straight at Grandmaster Avernus. Not surprisingly, her birds did her no good. The spear hit her with such force that it carried her body all the way across the room, pinning her to the stone wall only a few feet from Alan. Alan stared at her for a second or two, horrified, before he forced himself to move. Unlikely as it was, maybe some quick healing could save the Grandmaster's life. The spear moved, scraping against the stone wall, before it pulled itself free and hurtled back into the fight of its own accord. Grandmaster Avernus flopped to the ground. Her long gray hair was in disarray, and for the first time, she didn't look like she had everything under control. She seemed lost. She opened her mouth to speak, but her strength left her, and she died before he could do anything more than summon some rose light. Beside him, Alan heard more crashes and explosions, along with the Enosh travelers yelling at one another in evident panic. Then he turned and, for the first time, got a good look at their enemy. King Zacharith the Sixth stood in the center of the Enosh travelers, a gold-headed spear in one hand and a huge black shield in the other. He wore armor of black and gold, with huge decorative rubies here and there. Over his head rose a tall, spiked, black and gold crown, with a single ruby above his forehead. He should have looked ornamental, like a statue, or a fanciful painting of a warrior king long after his reign had ended. He didn't. He looked like he could stand alone against an army of titans and not expect a single scratch on his breastplate. Only one thing confused Alan. He knew very little of the King of Damasca, but he had heard stories. The man was supposed to have a red eye that allowed him to see the hearts of men, spirits, or the future, depending on which version of the story you heard. King Zacharith had one good eye, but his other was covered by a black eye patch. Maybe he hid the red eye beneath the patch? Regardless, he was smearing the Enosh travelers all over the floor. It was about time that Alan became involved. As he watched Zacharith skewer a huge summoned cat with his spear and smash a traveler into unconsciousness with his shield, showing agility that, by rights, he should have lost 40 years past, Alan wondered what exactly he could be expected to do. Obviously, the king had the full might of Ragnaros behind him, and he was more than a match for almost a dozen fully trained travelers from Enosh. Alan had every confidence in his own abilities, but what was he supposed to do against that? Alesia had many other powers. Supposedly, the City of Light contained the counters and complements to each other territory. And the doors were unlocked. He could go, right now, and take so many powers from his territory that King Zacharith would bow to him. He could end this war in the time it took him to travel to Alesia and back. "You stop controlling the power," Ralia had said. "The power starts controlling you." Alan struggled for a moment, but he had made his decision when he left the Rose District without opening any of the other doors. He would fight this battle with the power he had earned. If he died, well, if he died, at least he wouldn't lose his mind and incarnate. He could rest easy knowing that, at the very least, he wouldn't endanger his former allies. Not that he was in any hurry to die, if it came to that. Alan knelt and pressed his palm to the floor tiles, reaching out to the golden power of Alesia in almost, but not quite, the same way he would have tried to make a gate.
Marikos, Alan said. It's time. A golden rent, very close to a gate, appeared above the floor like a frozen bolt of lightning. Marikos appeared, his wolf's jaws parted in a canine grin, his golden staff clutched in one hand. He adjusted his sash as he came through, casting a quick glance at the battlefield.
"Please tell me I get to fight the spearman in the middle," Marikos said. "He looks like a real challenge."
"Have at him," Alan said. The wolf snarled in what Alan thought was glee, running off with bestial speed to clash with King Zachareth. Alan remained kneeling on the floor for a moment, trying to catch his breath. Calling the various powers of Elysia was tiring enough, but summoning someone was always an order of magnitude higher. With most of the Enosh travelers dead or unconscious, King Zachareth was left with four opponents. Marikos, who whirled his staff with savage enthusiasm, Grandmaster Naraka, the Asphodel Mistbinder that Alan had met earlier, and Heir Talos. Without his sword, Talos had taken to fighting with what seemed to be a jeweled staff, though from what Alan could tell, he mostly used it to deflect his father's spear. Finally, with enough strength to walk, Alan began to move closer. He was just in time to hear the royal heir whine.
"Where is it, father?" Talos screamed. "Where have you hidden it?"
King Zachareth leaped over a tendril of mist and splattered a fireball on his shield, parrying Marikos's staff with his spear in the same motion. For all that, his voice seemed relatively calm when he answered,
"Where is your sword, son?"
"Tell me!"
Talos demanded.
"You don't deserve to know," the king noted. "You're weak, selfish, and impatient. I have no use for you."
He kept his eyes on Talos, but smashed his shield into Marikos's nose and knocked Grandmaster Naraka over with the back of his spear, interrupting her summoning. Talos laughed harshly.
"I had only one more use for you," he said. "I thought at least one good thing would come of losing my eye, but no. Now you're not even good for that. How ironic."
Alan wondered what, if anything, Talos was contributing to this battle, besides being a constant distraction for his father. The king slammed the edge of his shield down on the forehead of the Asphodel traveler, who crumpled in a heap of gray robes. Her mist dissipated almost immediately. Zachareth turned, engaging Marikos in a heated battle, spear against quarterstaff. His voice barely sounded strained.
"That's not irony," he said. "This is irony. I'm so proud of what you've become, son. Truly, you will be a credit to your sister's service."
For the first time, something seemed to shock Talos speechless. He stood there, his mouth hanging open, as Zachareth battled the wolfman from Elysia. It was time for Alan to get involved. He raised one cupped hand, calling out to his territory, and hurled a ball of destructive golden light at the king. Without so much as turning around, Zachareth smacked the ball of light from the air with the head of his spinning spear, whirling the weapon around for another strike at Marikos. His voice bored on, relentless.
"You will serve Leah as your queen, or you will join your sister in exile. Or you can let me kill you here."
Alan threw another ball of golden power, but it met the same fate as the first. Zachareth finally seemed to tire of fighting Marikos, disengaging and taking two steps back before hurling his spear like a javelin. It blasted through the wolfman's chest, tearing a ragged hole through him, and struck the tile before flipping back into Zachareth's waiting hand. He snagged it out of the air, barely giving the wolfman's corpse a second glance, and ignoring Alan entirely. Alan wasn't prepared for the surge of anger and regret that passed through him as Marikos died. He had never known Marikos particularly well. They fought occasionally, and that was the extent of their relationship.
but he had summoned the wolf here. Marikos risked his life gladly, even eagerly, for a chance at a good battle, but dying so suddenly, so casually.
Talos spat at his father's feet, even as he backpedaled furiously, trying to put as much distance between them as possible.
"It doesn't matter who you named successor. Not when I walk out of here with your crown and your spear."
King Zachareth caught another of Alan's attacks on his shield.
"I have every intention of making the announcement myself."
Alan had never been in such an infuriating fight. He had been outmatched before, but he had never been so thoroughly ignored. He walked over to Grandmaster Naraka, offering her a hand up.
"Can you summon something that will kill him?"
Grandmaster Naraka wheezed as she let herself be pulled to her feet.
"I can give us some time while we escape," she answered. "We never should have challenged him here. But when we saw him alone, we thought... Well, never mind. I can do something, child. Give me some time."
"Right," Alan said, and summoned his sword. Before he let himself think about what he was doing, he ran at King Zachareth's back, sword first. The king may have had only one eye, but it didn't impede his vision much. He spun around and turned Alan's sword of golden light on the head of his spear, smashing his shield into Alan's chest. Thanks to the armor, the blow didn't hurt much, but it pressed on him like a giant's fist. Behind the king, Talos raised his staff, squinting his eyes in focus. A crimson fireball flew from its tip, crashing into King Zachareth's armored back. Alan had a close-up view of the king's expression, and he flinched. It looked as though King Zachareth had felt a mosquito bite his hand, and he was just bothered enough to waste time crushing it. Zachareth shoved Alan backwards and turned toward his son. The Damascan heir caught one look at his father's face, turned on his heel, and ran. King Zachareth pulled his spear back as if to throw it, but hesitated, thinking better of it. He swung it back to Alan instead, who caught it on a half-dome of translucent green light.
"Alesia," the king said, "I've never fought one of you."
Alan raised his offhand and fired a blast of golden light at Zachareth's chest from inches away, but he still managed to somehow catch the blast on his shield.
"That's a coincidence. I've never fought a madman before."
Come to think of it, he actually had fought a madman before, but thinking up clever retorts in the heat of combat was harder than the stories made it sound.
"Tell me something," Zachareth responded. "Out of academic curiosity, I've always wondered why one would choose to ally themselves with Enosh. They are nothing more than a cult of the incarnations, a suicide pact, preparing to burn the world."
Alan brought his golden sword down at the king's head, though he was blocked by an almost casual shift of Zachareth's shield.
"They don't sacrifice innocence," Alan said. "They don't spill blood of their citizens in the name of security and stability."
King Zachareth thrust his spear at Alan's midsection, his expression never changing.
"Don't they? How many do you think will be sacrificed if the incarnations are released?"
Alan had no answer for that, so he put up a green wall between them to give himself time to recover. In fact, he wasn't sure he had enough breath left to speak. The strain of his repeated summonings was threatening to lose this fight for him. He had to end it soon. The king paced on his side of the green wall, content to wait it out.
"My ancestors planted the first 9 hanging trees for a good reason. I planted a 10th myself. They are the only things standing between this land and total, deadly anarchy."
Zachareth raised his spear, slamming it against the green wall. Luminescent cracks began to spider across its surface, and Alan pressed his hands against the wall, willing it to hold.
"Don't join their misguided suicidal club," the king went on. You weren't born in Enosh. You can think outside of their madness. Let the trees stand.
Alan thought of the incarnations, and couldn't help but agree that releasing them must be a horrible decision. But, in the end, he couldn't do it.
Not if you have to kill your own people to do it, Alan said, firmly and finally.
The king looked at him with his one remaining eye.
You're innocent, he said at last.
He shook his head and let out a sigh.
I can respect that. But you'll learn if you live long enough.
With that, he took two steps back and hurled his spear through Alan's green wall. The light shattered underneath the assault, sending red-hot shards of glass shooting into Alan's brain. He screamed, clutching his head, as his world was swallowed in white. When he could see again, Grandmaster Naraka was standing, somehow unharmed, opposite King Zachareth, who had his spear back in one hand. Between them stood a red-skinned old man, who was obviously not human. His gray beard reached down almost to his toes, and his scarlet skin was as tough and gnarled as an old oak's wood. He held a long gray noose in his hand that seemed formed out of ash, and his fingers kept sliding down the rope, caressing it, as if his hands had taken on a mind of their own.
Guilty,
the old man whispered, in a voice like dust and paper. He spun the noose around his head and threw it like a lasso. The king sidestepped, catching the loop of rope on the edge of his shield and readying his spear to throw. But a second later, he stiffened, almost dropping his spear to the ground. Impossibly, the rope had somehow still ended up around King Zachareth's neck, and now the red-skinned old man pulled it tighter and tighter. Grandmaster Naraka cackled, her red spectacles flashing in the bloody light.
Your Majesty, meet Haresh, Arbiter of Betrayal. I've wanted to introduce him to you for a long, long time. For crimes against those who trusted you, Haresh said. I pronounce you guilty. The sentence is death.
King Zachareth's voice grated as he pulled at the noose, trying to speak.
Haresh, he choked out. Grandmaster Naraka, you are not welcome here.
The ruby in the front of his crown flared. A wave of crimson light blasted out from the king, exactly like the power Leah had used against the incarnation earlier. Only this time, instead of being chained in one place, the Grandmaster and her Arbiter were swept down the hall like dust before a broom. They physically tumbled out, so quickly and so violently that for a moment Alan wondered about the Grandmaster's safety. When they reached the end of the vault, the silver doors slammed shut. King Zachareth pulled the ash-gray noose from over his head and turned to regard Alan.
Now, Alesia, the king said, how will this end?
Chapter 23 Seeds. Though her bones ached and her head felt as though it would split open, Grandmaster Naraka finally managed to climb to her feet. The agony threatened to paralyze her, but she was used to mere pain. Any Naraka traveler was. After groping around on the floor for another moment, she managed to find her spectacles and press them against her face. They improved her vision a little, painting everything in a soothing shade of red. Considering the torches outside the Crimson Vault, she didn't need much help seeing the world in red, but the spectacles were a comfort. The Arbiter, Haresh, made a sound like a hiss. He ran his ash-gray rope through his hands, tightening it in a series of furious knots. Without warning, he ran up and pounded on the silver doors of the vault. The doors rang like a gong, but they didn't give, not an inch. Even the torches to either side of the door seemed undisturbed, burning merrily along.
Let me in, the Arbiter hissed.
Legend told that his voice had been burned away long ago. She was never sure if that was true or nothing more than a ghost story. The Arbiters were among the most powerful beings any Naraka traveler could summon. Bringing one into being here, on the material plane, meant certain victory in battle. Certain victory, unless you tried to face down a Ragnaros traveler at the heart of the Crimson Vault. The Grandmaster doubted anyone had managed to test that before.
Well, you got your chance, Talos said bitterly. How did you like your taste of my father's spear?
The heir stood with his back to the doors of the vault, his hands in the air. A swirling red gate formed before him.
No better than you, I expect, Grandmaster Naraka responded calmly.
It had been 60 years since anyone his age could get a rise out of her. He didn't look much like the dignified royal heir anymore. His curled golden hair was matted down with blood, and his empty eye socket was bleeding through the bandage that wrapped his face. His skin was soaked in sweat, and his breathing sounded ragged. If he didn't find a healer, he wouldn't last the night.
Well, she thought, at least he won't have to worry about that.
Talos finally finished the gate. It opened on a room of blue stone. She had no doubt that the hanging tree would be nearby. If this was the only place where Ragnaros gates came out, the Ragnaros incarnation would surely be buried nearby. The presence of the territory would help keep the incarnation in check. Talos stepped through the portal, and Grandmaster Naraka followed on his heels. Two men in blue uniforms stepped forward.
Highness, one said, what happened? This woman behind me is a traitor from Enosh, Talos said casually. Kill her.
Maybe if she were 15 years old and also a fool, such an action would have caught Grandmaster Naraka off guard. One of the blue-uniformed guards whipped his wrist forward, a silver key appearing as if by magic. Tartarus. He was a good choice for guarding a location such as this. Tartarus travelers summoned quickly, and they tended to accept orders well. He would cut down most hostile travelers in an instant. Grandmaster Naraka was not most travelers. With her left hand, she still had to get used to using her left hand and not her right, she finished the complex movement that she had begun before she even stepped through the Ragnaros gate. She called for fire, and the furnace of judgment answered. A bright, unnaturally orange fireball streaked forward from her hand, wailing as it flew through the air. It wrapped around the traveler in a tightening, burning ring, its screams rising to match the voice of the man trapped inside. Fire from the furnace wouldn't kill this traveler, no matter how much he might wish for it. The second guard was also a Tartarus, but slower of hand than his counterpart. He was only halfway through summoning a flying blade before a gray rope tightened around his throat. His eyes bulged, the rope tightened, and he was pulled back through the still-open Ragnaros gate. Talos didn't wait to see the fate of his guardian. He staggered away, clutching his side, trying his hardest to run. Grandmaster Naraka didn't bother to follow. He wouldn't escape. A loud crunching noise rang out from inside the Crimson Vault, like a horse being crushed between two boulders. An instant later, an ash-gray rope flew out, the noose at the end fastening around Talos's neck. The heir scrabbled at the noose around his neck, trying to pull the rope free. His voice scraped out of his throat, but it was weak. Someone would be coming soon in any case, because of the guard's screams. She would have to be quick. Haresh stepped out of the Ragnaros gate, continuing to pull his rope taut. Talos fell onto his back and was dragged closer and closer to the Arbiter. The guard had collapsed, unconscious. The flames from the furnace died out. Haresh lowered himself to one red-skinned knee his beard brushing the blue tiles.
I smell betrayal on you, heir of Damasca, he whispered. You have betrayed everyone who ever trusted you. For this, you will hang.
Grandmaster Naraka leaned over the heir. He deserved every second of this, if not more. He was a Ragnaros traveler, and thus he gained his power from the blood of others. More than that, he was a traitor. He had earned this fate, but before that, she still had a use for him. The Grandmaster smiled down at Talos.
First, she said, you will answer my questions.
Alan rose to his feet, mentally going down the checklist of everything he had left. There were a few other beings he could summon from the Gold District, but he doubted any of them would fare any better against the King's Spear. He certainly didn't want anyone he knew ending up like Marikos. From the Green District, he could summon something like a turtle, which might be able to stand up to a direct impact from the spear. It wouldn't do him much good in combat, though. He could summon an arrow trap, he supposed, and fill the vault with an onslaught of golden arrows. But he doubted very much that any one of those darts would pierce the king's black shield. Besides, he was running out of strength. Whatever he summoned next would likely be the last thing he called. King Zachareth stood looking down on him for a moment, his blue eye blazing. Then he threw his shield down. His spear followed quickly after, then his crown. Alan stood, his mouth gaping, wondering if he was seeing reality or if this was some kind of hopeful dream. The king seemed to age decades before his eyes, sagging and bending under his own body's weight.
No artifact of Ragnaros comes without a price, he said,
and surprisingly his voice was as strong as ever.
When you get to be my age, strength like that isn't without its price, either.
What was your price? Alan asked, curious in spite of himself.
My life, the king responded casually.
He picked his way carefully across the gore and debris-strewn floor, edging over to the wall. Alan kept the ball of light close to summoning, in case the king tried to pull out another weapon. He didn't expect that to happen. The only weapon Zachareth would have needed to kill him was his spear, and he had thrown that down. But it couldn't hurt to be safe. The king went on, his voice strangely even.
When I saw that Talos had betrayed me, bringing a strike force from Enosh here, well, I don't think any of them expected to find me here, any more than I expected to see them. You planned to stride into the palace and burn the tree, didn't you?
Alan wasn't sure about the wisdom of revealing his strategy to his biggest enemy, but the king appeared to know everything already.
That's most of it, yes, Alan responded.
King Zachareth pulled a box off a nearby shelf, quickly checking the label underneath.
I thought as much. Regardless, when I saw your friends come in, I knew they would kill me.
He met Alan's eyes, and the corner of his lips turned up in what could almost, on another man, have been a smile.
Two grandmasters and a dozen of the finest travelers in Enosh? That's a noble death. My successor is secure. Still, I wish I had more...
He cut off, choking, clutching at his chest with one hand. He sagged to the floor, leaning against the wall for support on the way down. He kept the box cradled in one arm the entire time. On instinct, Alan stepped forward to help, but he stopped himself. No telling if the king was up to some devious trap, though if he gained some advantage from this charade, Alan couldn't see it. The king opened the box and fished around in it for a moment before holding something up for Alan to see. It was an oblong ball, about the same size as a walnut. It seemed to be red, but in this light, so did everything else. As far as Alan knew, it might even be a walnut.
This, the king said, is the seed of a hanging tree.
Alan took one involuntary step back. King Zachareth's voice hardened.
If you have any sense of responsibility within you, you'll take it. Use it if anything happens to the trees. The incarnations...
Suddenly he seemed to choke again. Or maybe he simply ran out of breath. For reasons Alan didn't quite understand, he took the seed. He could always burn it later, he supposed. But if he needed it, well, it would be better to have it in case he needed it, that was all. For now, he had one last question for the dying king.
Why me? He asked.
The king waited for his bout of choking to subside before he answered.
Ragnaros wasn't always the guardian of the incarnations. More than 300 years ago, it was Elysia.
Alan had heard that before, back in Enosh, but he had thought it was an Enosh legend. He was somewhat surprised to hear the king confirm the story.
I thought that was a legend, Alan responded warily, clutching the seed in his fist.
His pockets were hidden beneath his armor, where he couldn't reach, but he would carry the seed with him back to Enosh, even if he had to clutch it in his fist the entire time.
You know my daughter, Leah? King Zachareth asked.
He sounded as if he already knew the answer, but Alan nodded.
Tell her, I wanted more time. I wanted...
He choked again, then shook his head, changing what he was about to say.
I wanted a lot of things. Now, Elysian traveler, Zachareth said, once more cold and businesslike, I have trusted you beyond what is wise. Do me a favor in return.
He tapped the center of his breastplate with one gauntleted finger.
Your sword, one stroke, make it clean.
By his tone, you would think he was ordering breakfast. Alan thought he would have had no problem complying with that request. But when he looked at Zachareth now, he didn't see the heartless king at the head of an evil empire. He saw a sick, dying old man. But he pictured the people of Enosh and how they would feel if he could tell them, with complete honesty, that he had slain the king of Damascus. They would feel safe again, empowered even. In the end, he summoned his sword of golden light and thrust it through King Zachareth's chest. Outside the silver doors, Grandmaster Naraka waited. A gate hung open behind her, leading to a room that Alan assumed was located somewhere in the royal palace in Cana. They seemed to have used a lot of blue. The Grandmaster herself was a mess. She was covered in bloody scrapes that looked even worse than the ruby light of Ragnaros, and she could barely stand straight without leaning against the wall. One lens of her spectacles was cracked.
Is he dead? She asked.
Alan nodded, his fist tightening on the red seed. The motion attracted the old woman's gaze.
What is it that you have there? She asked.
A seed, Alan responded.
He offered no other details. She held out a hand.
Give it to me,
she ordered.
It's mine.
Alan could just make out her eyes narrowing behind her glasses.
As you wish, Eliadel. Will you plant it?
Don't worry about that, Alan said. We have a mission to complete.
The Grandmaster cackled, following him through the gate into the royal palace.
As always, I'm a step ahead of you.
She seemed like she was in a strangely good mood. Warily, Alan glanced at her.
You don't seem overcome by grief, he noted. We lost a lot of good people today.
We won, Grandmaster Naraka answered. Now many more good people will have a chance to live.
Then Alan stepped off the blue pedestal, away from the Ragnaros Gate, and he realized what Grandmaster Naraka had meant when she said she had won. Talos's body lay sprawled on the blue tiles, his face blue and purple as though he had been strangled. A livid red mark wrapped around the skin of his neck, and Alan couldn't help thinking about the red-skinned arbiter's gray noose. He didn't mind that Talos was dead. He didn't even particularly care that Grandmaster Naraka had killed him. In her long life, she had undoubtedly done far worse. But somehow, seeing it in front of him, staring down at the corpse of a man who had once been strong and confident, that made it all so much worse. But that wasn't all. A staircase led down from the pedestal, down into the floor, penetrating all the way down into the heart of the royal palace. From the open trap door at the top of the stairs, Alan guessed that the staircase was usually hidden underneath a secret panel in the tile. At the end of the tunnel, a red tree writhed in agony amid dancing flames.
"You see," Grandmaster Naraka said, "it's our victory. The incarnations are free."
Among the flames, the silhouette of a single hand thrust into the air. Alan had never opened an Elysian gate any faster. In seconds, the two of them were in the City of Light, leaving Kena behind them to whatever destruction the incarnation of Ragnaros decided to inflict. In Belcalum, Adrienne Lamarcus Diocese was almost unsurprised to hear the house rumble beneath her feet. She threw her pen down on her writing desk, hurrying outside to find Petrus. The balding one-armed traveler stood outside her door, looking grim.
"This is it," he said, and she began running down the hall to her daughter's rooms.
"How long?" she asked, and he shook his head. "It's already started."
Adrienne passed a stained glass window depicting an ancient overlord signing a peace treaty with the natives of Helgard. She could barely see the garden outside, but she noticed when the entire garden spontaneously burst into flames. She ran faster. Both of the girls were hysterical, insisting that they had seen monsters outside the window, and asking if the house would burn down. But she ignored their questions, gathering them up and rushing them outside to Petrus.
"Have the evacuation orders been issued?" she asked.
5 minutes ago, my lady," Petrus replied.
"Then open a gate," she ordered.
Malachi would have never run from this, but she had come to a realization in the weeks since his death. She was not, and should not be, her husband. He might have been able to battle this incarnation toe-to-toe, but she was no traveler. And despite the pain it may cause her, she would not stay aboard a sinking ship. She and her daughter followed Petrus into Naraka, which caused her daughters to bury their faces in her skirts. It was dark and hot, and it smelled like death. But this was the one place where the incarnation would never follow them. At least, that was what Malachi had always said.
"Take us to the south quarter," she said. "I have a shelter there, and from that position we can reorganize the city."
Petrus eyed her sadly and shook his head, leading them down the tunnel by the light of his glowing palm.
"I'm sorry, my lady. I cannot."
"Why not?"
"Because by the time we get there, the incarnation will have burned it to the ground. The city is lost."
An Avernus traveler poked her head into Leah's tent. She must have been fresh off a bird, judging by her appearance. Her hair was still blown about as though she had wrestled a windstorm, and she was still wearing her flying goggles.
"That's a report from Belcalum," she said. "The city is in flames."
Leah sighed and nodded to the woman, who bowed and immediately left. Indiriel leaned over the map of Damasca they had on the table, pushing a red pin into Belcalum.
"That's four," he said. "Andros, Hornheim, Naraka, and Ragnaros."
"Slay one incarnation, and four more rise to take its place," Leah said wearily.
"You know how this works better than anyone," Indiriel responded. They managed to burn a tree. I don't know which one, maybe Deborah's. Maybe even mine. That incarnation escapes. But all the trees are connected, so maybe the next weakest tree falls. And then the next. And the dominoes keep falling, Leah finished. I know. At least we're sure Helgard and Lyriel still stand.
I'm certain Tartarus still stands as well, Indiriel added. Overlord Cyrus won't let his tree go so easily, and his sacrifice was relatively fresh.
So in the best-case scenario, almost half of the incarnations are loose on our nation.
Leah sighed and rubbed her temples.
You know I have to go to my father with this.
I have no doubt he already knows, Indiriel said. But yes, you do. Go on. I can handle matters here.
Leah walked around the map table, opening her gate where it wouldn't merge with the table. Gates could do some awkward things if you tried to open them where a solid object could interfere. From failing to open at all, to sucking that object into the territory, to slicing the object in half. She preferred to eschew such risks entirely. When she reached the Crimson Vault, she knew something was wrong. The silver doors were cracked open.
Indiriel, she called,
and immediately the Valenhall Traveler stood at her side. Indiriel took in the situation at a glance. The door had been smeared with blood, recently, or it would have been absorbed into the silver, and left open a crack. Through the door, Leah could already see a body in the vault itself. The Overlord preceded her through the doors, the chains on his arms coming to life and crawling slowly up his forearms. Travelers littered the front hallway of the vault, but Leah ignored them, at the sight of one body, lying far enough back that she could barely see him. The body of a one-eyed old man, encased in black and gold armor. Leah hurried to her father's side, doing everything she could not to look at the gaping hole in the front of his armor. She knelt beside him, pressing fingers to his neck. She felt nothing. Slowly, Leah stood back up. She looked around, trying to piece the scene together.
Enosh, Indiriel said, certainly.
He stood farther back in the vault, in the open chambers where the largest weapons were kept, examining the remnants of the battle.
I recognize the clothing.
Slowly, Leah stood back up. She looked around, trying to piece the scene together.
Enosh, Indiriel said, certainly.
He stood farther back in the vault, in the open chambers where the largest weapons were kept, examining the remnants of the battle.
I recognize the clothing, and I've met Grandmaster Avernus before.
How did they get in here, Indiriel?
Leah asked. She was surprised at how level her voice sounded.
There's only one way into Ragnaros, the Overlord responded. His voice boiled with anger, and he viciously kicked one of the nearby bodies.
Talos. Leah raised a hand to pull aside the eye patch, but she hesitated, unwilling to peel away the black fabric.
Did he take even Father's eye? She whispered. Would he stoop so low?
Indiriel remained silent as he moved up beside her. He was holding something out to her, a small box, like one in which a jeweler might place a ring.
What is this? She asked.
Your father asked me to hold this for you, Indiriel said. I didn't understand why, but now it seems obvious.
Carefully, Leah took the box from his hand and pulled it open. Nestled within, in a velvet lining, was a bright red stone. No, not a stone. A crimson eye. Alan stepped out of the Naraka gate and into Myria. He had brought Grandmaster Naraka back to Enosh first, but he hadn't wasted any time in finding another Naraka traveler to take him where he wanted to go. He had been faced with a dilemma. He wanted to keep the journey secret, especially from Grandmaster Naraka, so choosing one of her loyal travelers seemed foolish. But at the same time, Naraka was the fastest way in and out. And if this was going to work, he needed to be quick. Alan saluted the young Naraka traveler. He bowed back, much deeper than he needed to, and gestured to the others in his party. His sisters followed him out of the territory, simultaneously trying to cough and take a deep breath of clean air.
"I'll be glad never to set foot in there again," Alana said, wiping sweat from her forehead with the back of her hand.
Tamara nodded her agreement, but Shai appeared greatly encouraged by the experience.
"Was that a sea of melted rock?" she asked eagerly. "How does rock melt?"
"In a very hot fire, if I had to venture a guess," Alan said. "Now, listen to me." He kept walking them deeper into the village, farther away from the traveler. He didn't want a word of this leaking back to Grandmaster Naraka. "I'll be back for you," he said. "Keep it hidden. Don't show it to anyone. Don't take it out. Don't even talk about it. Do you understand?"
"There's only one person here who has trouble keeping secrets," Tamara said. "You should be saying these things into a mirror."
Alan couldn't help but glance down at Tamara's travel bag, where she held the seed to the hanging tree. He wasn't about to keep it in Enosh, not with Grandmaster Naraka around to burn it, but he had the feeling he might need it someday. Tamara pulled the bag open, out of his line of sight.
"You see," she said, "it's suspicious the way you keep staring at the bag. Ignore it, it'll go away."
"It's probably dangerous," Alan cautioned.
"You warned us," Alana reminded him.
"Don't take it apart," Alan continued, with a look at Shai. She still had the same bored expression as ever when she shrugged.
"No promises."
"I'll visit when I can, but I can't do it too often," Alan said. "It might raise suspicion. And I don't know what's going to happen with the war now that the king is dead."
Alana stepped forward, giving him a quick hug.
"You don't have to remind us of that so often, you know. Tell Leah I'm sorry we didn't get a chance to say goodbye. I went looking for her last night, and I couldn't find her. Whatever happened to her, anyway?"
Grandmaster Lyriel slid the crystal lens over, giving Grandmaster Naraka a clear look at Alan and his sisters in Myria.
"Whatever it is, it's almost certainly from Ragnaros," Grandmaster Lyriel concluded.
Naraka stared into the lens, glaring at Alan as though she could set him on fire from across the miles.
"It's a seed,"
Grandmaster Lyriel gasped. His or her artificial voice. Even Grandmaster Naraka didn't know if Lyriel was a man or a woman. Made it sound less like a gasp and more like a quiet shriek.
"We must have that seed," Lyriel said.
"I agree,"
Grandmaster Naraka said. She drummed her fingers on the table thoughtfully.
"But which do we need more desperately? The seed to a hanging tree, or an Elysian traveler?"
Behind the mask of silver ribbons, Grandmaster Lyriel stayed silent for a long time.
"I would say that Eliadel has fulfilled his role in prophecy," Lyriel said carefully. "He has, at last, confronted King Zacharith, the Evening Star. With the hanging trees gone, the sacrifice will end, thus stemming the tide of blood. And now that the Incarnation's prison is beginning to break..."